This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's begin today in Massachusetts' 3rd Congressional District, where a lot has been going on lately. The district includes the city of Lawrence, the town of Andover. They're among the 3 communities, along with North Andover, hit by those terrifying gas explosions last week that killed one person, injured dozens more, while sparking fires in some 80 buildings. It's also where the chaotic and closely contested Democratic congressional primary was finally settled this week in favor of Lori Trahan, who will face Republican Rick Green in November. The winner of that race will replace outgoing Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, who's retiring at the end of the current term, and she joins us now. Welcome, Congresswoman Tsongas. It's great to have you on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Anthony. It's good to be with you.
So I'd like to start, if I could, with those gas explosions last week. Yesterday, you and Congressman Seth Moulton sent a letter to leaders of the House Energy and Commerce Committee requesting hearings on what happened. You pointed out that this is a tragic moment for thousands of residents in the Merrimack Valley, some of whom who lost everything. Are you going to get those hearings, and what do you want them to accomplish?
Well, we will certainly work hard to make sure they take place. We know the National Transportation Safety Board is now in the district taking a look to determine what happened, you know, what caused the explosions in the first place, and has some initial sense that it was due to overpressurization. Mm-hmm. What we still don't know, though, is the extent of the damage in the piping, and that's something that has to be determined before gas can be turned on in all those homes that were impacted by this event. So it's still very much a work in progress, but we in Washington, I think we need to engage in our individual oversight responsibilities. It's certainly about this pipeline and these particular pipes, but I think it also raises other issues about the general status of our pipelines across this country. And this incident is an example of what can go wrong when we're not engaging, when we in Congress are not engaging in effective oversight over our regulatory entities, and that's really what we want to get to the bottom of.
Yeah, it certainly puts a spotlight on what happens when infrastructure, I guess, is allowed to crumble and to get too old. Does it raise questions about relying on natural gas going forward, though?
Well, I think it always seems to be, as my experience in Washington, is when these accidents happen is when we ask all the questions, both small and large, and yeah, they need to be asked. I think it's unfortunate too often we wait for these accidents to happen before those questions are asked. But in any case, you know, that's what we're moving ahead on. Yes, the issue of natural gas and natural gas safety is always important. We've certainly gone through major discussions in my district when new pipeline proposals have come in, and the deep concerns that constituents have, neighborhoods have over what the impact will be, the safety of them. So, yes, I think there are always hard questions that we have to ask about the various forms of energy that we use. And this certainly is an example of, again, where we come to look, have to take a hard look at what our sources of energy are, but the ways in which they're delivered to our households and our businesses. Mm.
One more question about the letter that you and Congressman Seth Moulton wrote yesterday. You wrote, "Unfortunately, confusion has reigned in the response efforts." What part of the response most concerns you?
Well, from the outset, Columbia Gas really did not communicate at all with the residents of the affected communities. I mean, people waited altogether too long for the company to really acknowledge in any real way what had happened. And then the company was not forthcoming in giving residents any sense of their way forward. I know in talking with a vice president of the company, I had a clear sense they didn't even have a communication plan, sort of a generic communication plan in place when something like this happened. You know, you never want them to happen, but I think in any event, any utility that has potential to have an incident like this where there's real harm needs to have a plan in place to immediately communicate with those affected. So that was number one. It was just simply too long. They would make promises about their way forward that were not kept. And inevitably, the governor declared a state of emergency and brought Eversource in. And right, then things seemed to calm down. But so progress is being made. those homes that where gas was shut off as a precaution, they weren't in the impacted area, but just to be safe, in general, gas is back on in, I think, a good percentage of those. But obviously, we know we have all those many households where they now have electricity, but they won't have gas for some time to come. And it's yet to, we're not yet very clear on what that path forward is. Is it going to take replacing all of the pipelines, or is it really first we have to determine what the damage was to the pipelines currently in place before they can have a sort of scheduled process for turning on gas? So a lot of questions remain.
Yeah, you mentioned about replacing those pipelines. Columbia Gas says it's going to replace 48 miles of aging pipeline in all three of those towns. Governor Baker has made it clear that Columbia is going to foot this bill, but what stops a gas company from passing these costs on to consumers? I mean, is that part of sort of your regulatory oversight, I guess, to protect consumers?
Well, I think obviously we see in our attorney general, our state attorney general, has indicated that that she certainly is opposed to that. I certainly would question their ability to pass on to the ratepayers until we have a clear plan that we all agree will be effective in safely restoring gas to the impacted residents.
Right. I want to stay in the 3rd District and talk about politics. It took 2 weeks, a lot of confusion, a recount, but now we know that Lori Trahan is going to be the Democrat who hopes to replace you in Congress. She's going to face Republican Rick Green and Independent Mike Mullen in November. First of all, is there a sense of relief among you Democrats that this is finally settled up there? It took a while.
I would say we're relieved and raring to go.
Yeah.
We had a great pool of candidates. We had 10 people running. It was as diverse as you could ever ask for, 5 women, 5 men, diverse in terms of its ethnicity, diverse ethnicities representing the great diversity of the district itself, diverse in every way, extraordinary talent in this group. And given that, the choice was hard.
Yeah.
And so it came down to Lori Trahan and Dan Coe, who requested a recount. I think he had every right to do so. But the outcome determined that Lori was, in fact, you know, a winner by 140-plus votes. So
and how do you
we
look
all
at,
came together, and off we go.
And how do you judge her chances in this race? We were chatting just before we went on the air. The 3rd District isn't necessarily a cakewalk for Democrats all the time, right?
I've learned that you have to earn every vote.
Yeah.
I think that should be true in any instance, frankly. I don't think anybody seeking public office should ever take a vote for granted. But this district is almost 60% independent. It's become more independent as I've been in office, with about 35% Democratic and the rest registered Republicans. So what that tells you is people really need to listen to, hear out, see what the particular point of view and what a member of Congress would seek to do in Washington. You have to earn their vote and their respect and their trust. And I think Lori Trahan is certainly prepared to do that. She understands well the challenges of this district. But in the end, I think in this time and place, what we need is to send somebody to Washington who will hold the Trump administration responsible and be a clear advocate for the things we care about as Democrats. So whether it's a access to health care and not undoing all the great progress we've made there, whether it's securing the hard-won rights that women have achieved over many decades, whether it's fairness so we don't have income inequality to the extent that we do, and that's a particular issue in pockets of this district, whether or not we're committed to environmental stewardship and protecting this earth for future generations, whether or not we see a role for regulation. I mean, I think one of the things about the pipeline incident that we've just had is there's a real debate in Washington. It tends to be one in which my colleagues across the aisle, my Republicans, do not see the federal government robustly enforcing laws that are designed to keep our air clean, our water clean, hold corporations accountable. That's a debate that plays itself out in many instances, and we really see what happens, what can happen when we don't do that appropriately, as we just have seen seen in Lawrence and Let me Andover.
Speaking of debates, I'd love to ask you about sort of the debate within the Democratic Party, which traditionally is always loud, fractious, lots of disagreements. In many ways, it's probably a good thing and healthy for the party. Now there's a division, I guess you could sort of describe it, between the progressives, the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and more establishment Democrats. Does that, what kind of challenge does that division pose for Democrats going forward?
Well, I have to say, as I've been in Washington, I've seen how we've managed to stay together in order to leverage the power, you know, the limited power we have in the minority. Mm-hmm. It's not simple, given that there are those differences, but I think we understand what's at stake and come together for the best interests of our country. That isn't to say in any given race some of those differences will play themselves out, but as we just saw, as we all came together yesterday, all 10 of us, one of us was missing. Juana Matias couldn't make it because she's from Lawrence and was there in response to this crisis. But we all came together, despite our differences, knowing that what's more important is the broader values we share, and that we obtain the majority in Washington so that we can move those values forward.
Yeah, so you don't see a risk, essentially, of the party almost becoming too fractious, the sort of Bernie Sanders wing, the progressive wing, pulling this party apart a little bit.
There will always be room for spirited debates.
Yes.
But I don't see and haven't seen any evidence of the kind of dysfunction that I've seen in the Republican Party as I've been in Washington, where they cannot even agree with themselves as to a way forward. And their disagreements are our Democratic Party's opportunity. So, for example, when we come to a point where we're having budget agreements and we finally have to fund government, and we will be having one of those yet again at the end, next week going forward. We come to the end of a budget cycle and we have to fund government. But because my colleagues across the aisle can't agree with themselves, we Democrats can play a role in making sure that, yes, for example, while we adequately fund how we defend our country, we also make sure we don't do it at the expense of everything else that is so important to the long-term progress of this of who we are. So investments in education, investments in health care. And those are opportunities we would not have were it not for the Republican Party's dysfunction. Hmm. And I think we've learned that lesson well, and we know that as we serve and should we reclaim the majority, that we will find a way forward that brings us together in the best interest of our country.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the large number of women, particularly Democratic women, running for office in this election cycle. We talked about this a bunch on the program yesterday. It's happening across the country. It's happening here in Massachusetts. Laura Trahan's an example. Ayanna Pressley's an example. You were a bit of a groundbreaker going to Congress from Massachusetts. What, you were the first? You were one of three?
I was the first woman in 25 years to Congress from Massachusetts, but only the fourth in total.
That's incredible. So we've got a pioneer here. So how do you explain what's going on now and what it portends for the coming midterm elections?
Well, one of the things I always say is women can't win if women don't run. And I think looking back, we've probably seen many, many decades, if not centuries, in which women did not seek to hold public office. So, number one, I think women are now recognizing that if they're not part of the public discourse, our rights and interests are not addressed. And I've seen that over and over and over again as I've been in Washington with an ever-growing number of elected members of Congress who happen to be women. So as I say, we can't win if we don't run. I think women are recognizing more how important it is that they're in Washington, that it's in Washington with a seat at the table that you can actually affect the change that makes a difference in your family's life, including mm-hmm. a woman's life or her children's life. And if we're not there, for example, our hard-fought gains can be quickly disregarded. Yeah. And so I think that you see so many women running is finally the recognition that this is an opportunity that shouldn't be ignored and that we have to be part of our nation's conversation. Years ago, I remember as a newly elected member being at an Army caucus, and the then chief of staff of the Army, got up and was asked a question, should women be allowed to fight in all positions, all combat-related positions, and brought in greater numbers into the Army. And he said, you can't have the best Army in the world if you exclude 50% of the population. You can't have the best Congress in the world if 50% of the population is not represented. And you can't have the best country in the world if 50% of the population is not part of our public life in whatever form it takes. And I think women ever more recognize that. They see that it's a job with tremendous opportunity. I say it's the best job in the world. The opportunities to make a difference are extraordinary. And when we're not there, as I said, too many things don't happen. I'm sure you've heard the story. I'm going to tell you one about women were never included in the trials at the National Institutes of Health until the women members of Congress forced change so that we are now included in all trials of, you know, whatever new invention is coming forward in terms of healthcare.
Right.
That's just one example of where we make a difference.
Well, this is related to this. Of course, I want to ask you about Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's Senate confirmation hearing. He's been accused, as we know, by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford of sexually assaulting her at a party when the two were teenagers in high school. You tweeted last night that you believe Dr. Ford, and that her accusations disqualify Brett Kavanaugh from serving on the Supreme Court. Why is that? I mean, should he be disqualified before he has a chance to come back before the Senate and talk about this?
I certainly, you know, one of the issues I focused on as in my tenure in Congress is on the issue of sexual assault in the military.
Right.
And I've seen a military culture that historically coalesced around the alleged assailant, that for whatever reason viscerally disbelieved the survivor. And I then, as we hear the Me Too stories, you see that over and over and over again. And reading a story about Mr. Moonves at CBS, the allegations were brought to the board of directors, and the board of directors, predominantly men, again, viscerally rejected the initial allegations.
And do you think that's what's going on here now?
It's something so ingrained. And as I say, if we women don't believe the stories of women, who on earth will believe them? I believe her. But I do think the FBI should be involved. This is a gentleman who, to get unearth it. While the Senate has said they are willing to hear from both of them, that will just be a he said, she said, yet another round of he said, she said. I think we need an independent investigation, especially since this is a gentleman that is being nominated to serve on the Supreme Court, which will be a lifetime a position that he will hold. And to me, if the Senate proceeds with a vote without that, essentially they are disregarding the equal rights of women.
Yeah.
That this is an instance of which we have to have an independent investigation.
Well, respond to this pushback, this idea of an FBI investigation. Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina tweeted yesterday that requiring an FBI investigation of a 36-year-old allegation is not about finding the truth. It is about delaying the process until the midterm elections.
Well, we have to remember, I think this whole notion around the timeline is sort of a constructed argument. This is a timeline that was put in place by Mr. McConnell in order to have this this vote take place before the midterm elections. There's nothing that says that has to be the timeline. As I said, this is a gentleman who will serve this country on the Supreme Court for the rest of his life. I think we should take all necessary time to do what's right by both of them. And I think an FBI investigation will prove or disprove, but I believe her, but he has every right to be disproved as well, if that's the fact. And only an FBI investigation can do that in a way that is satisfactory to the objectivity and the American public's need to know.
I want to ask you one more question about this. Many of us saw what Anita Hill wrote in the New York Times this week and about her experience testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee back in 1991, right, when she alleged that Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her. And among her points is that not a lot has changed about the way the Senate considers and vets these kinds of charges and claims. And I'm just wondering, as a woman in Congress, does that discourage you? Is she right? You know, have we really not progressed on this issue since 1991?
Well, time will tell.
Yeah.
Time will tell. It seems to me that if the FBI is allowed to investigate and the facts of that investigation are brought forward, and that the and as they're brought forward, they are taken into account by those who have to cast their votes, then we could say there has been change. I've seen, for example, in the military where, you know, we have been able to slowly but surely over the course of many years push for change. It's a different dynamic. There's a tradition of civilian oversight of the military. As I've worked across the aisle to enact legislation to force changes around how the services deal with these issues, there's an obligation for the services to take those changes into account. But it's still you know, a work in progress. Much work yet to be done, not just in the military, but obviously as we see these stories come forward in almost every venue of society.
A lot of work yet to do. Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas, she represents Massachusetts' 3rd District. She'll be retiring at the end of this term. Congresswoman, thank you for coming in, and I hope we get to talk to you at least one more time before you leave the delegation. Thank you for coming
in today. Thank you, Anthony.
Though. We really appreciate
it.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, the FDA is rolling out a new campaign to discourage teens from vaping. Will it work? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.